Got Steve Jones on today's episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're talking about a lot on today's episode. We're talking about the French rookies, Richardson, Hawks fans. You get to hear that. But first, we're talking about OKC in Denver, their series, the LeBron injury, Grizzlies offense, Bucks, Cavs, a whole bunch else. All that's coming up next with Steve Jones. All right, let's talk about the Thunder and Nuggets. They had a split series. OKC won the first game on Sunday, had a dominant second half, held Denver to only 43 points. SGA had 40. Everybody's talking about how he locked up the MVP. And then Denver on Monday, they win the second game, 140 to 127. With what was a dominant second half, put 73 on OKC's number one ranked defense. Jokic had 35, 18, and 8. These teams are 1-2 in the Western Conference right now. OKC is the favorite to go to the NBA Finals. Denver, they get a chance. They get the best player in the world in Jokic. Steve, what was your number one takeaway from this split series when it comes to those finals implications, playoff implications down the line?
I think it's a reminder of Denver's ceiling. I think sometimes people forget what Denver can be as a team because their roster has changed. And so what we think is they're not a contender is more they just don't have the same margin for error. But when they have Jokic playing like he was in that second half of that game, Jamal Murray humming at a high level, and very secretly, I know everyone's going to talk about Russell Westbrook being spaced in the shooting. He's got great chemistry with Jokic this year. He's done a really good job of developing that. Their role players understand who they are and what they have to contribute. A lot of made shots for the Nuggets, which obviously is going to be something that they'll have to do in the playoffs. But I just think it was a reminder of what they can do. I think for the Thunder, not having Jalen Williams, I thought offensively they were fine. Defensively, they have to hit certain notes to be able to maintain what they've done so far. I think that's something that stood out to me in that second half where they were really good offensively in the first half. So was Denver. Denver was able to keep that going. OKC slipped a little bit. So, I mean, they still put up 127, but I think defensively they're going to have to find a way to really cause havoc to really win a championship.
For sure. I mean, I think both notes are accurate. With Denver, the funny thing is their big run in the fourth quarter happened at the start with Jokic off the bench. Like I think it does show some of the layers of what the Nuggets can do. They're running MPJ off of screens, having him hit threes, Jamal Murray going off, having guys like Peyton Watson hit at threes in the corner. They're capable of raising their level collectively as a unit. I thought that was on display in that fourth quarter.
The other thing that stood out to me was just the doubling of Shea. And if teams are going to try and continue that facet where, you know, Shea crosses the ball across half court, two people are meeting him, and now does that put OKC in scramble mode? Like, I don't think zone is the answer. I don't think that's the answer. But it is interesting to see teams are just like, you know what? We're just going to try and take you away, get you guys to take quicker shots and try and get you out of rhythm that way. Because I think part of what's made OKC so good is they're not just drive and kick this year. They got pick and roll. They got cutters. They got handoffs. They have things for everyone. I think for a team, you got to get them out of rhythm to try and, like, make it tough.
I think that was the biggest thing for me in that game, because Jalen Williams plays only 13 minutes, and then Denver's just, you know, blitzing, pressuring SGA in that game, and that's been sort of a common thread in some of OKC's few losses this year. But I pulled up the numbers this season, and if you look at SGA when he's facing drop coverage, he's in the 98th percentile. The Thunder are in the 98th percentile when SGA is facing drop coverage. When he's switched against, they're in the 94th percentile of scoring. But when SGA is showed against or blitzed against, they score 0.99 points per pick and roll, which is in the 55th percentile. So they get a hell of a lot worse when SGA is, when teams are trying to force the ball out of his hands. Don't you, like, I would expect that's going to become a more common thing come postseason time, which means I'm sure Mark Daigneault, maybe he's got some stuff in his back pocket, get SGA going off ball in order to get into sets rather than pick and roll. But it also increases the importance of having Jalen Williams perform at a high level.
I think that's the part that sticks out to me. Jalen Williams got to play at a certain level. And the interesting part is if you shift it to Jalen Williams, our team's just going to be comfortable giving him drop? Are they going to be comfortable just switching against him and saying, hey, you get this pull up or you have to make a play? The interesting part about Shea, I think he's done a really good job with Isaiah Hartenstein in pick and roll. I think that's given them a good layer, especially when Hartenstein's making those floaters. But if teams are just going to double before you even get to a pick and roll, or when you try and back down and when you try and go one-on-one, what does that shift? So I think the thing about, for me, with Mark Dadnall is he's always had this holistic approach to try and make sure the full team is humming at a certain level. It's just going to be which buttons does he tap, because I think the biggest thing is you have to get OKC out of rhythm. If you're trying to beat them in a playoff series, we got to get you into quick shoot land where you are just now driving, finding openings. You maybe are taking quicker shots than you want. They're not bad shots. It's not that you can't shoot. It's just different than when you dictate, you know, with such a good offense they've had this year. That's probably going to be the problem or the challenge. I think that's why Jalen Williams is going to be so important, because if he's just getting switched and teams are doubling Shea, they're going to have to rely on their defense to transition a whole bunch.
I mean, I think you could argue, I mean, SGA, you know what he's going to do. You know what he can give you, what he's capable of giving you. Jalen Williams, I wrote an article on Yahoo Sports back in December. This was after the NBA Cup, and J-Dub did not perform well in the NBA Cup for the Thunder, and it was kind of a reminder of what he did in the postseason, where he just did not perform at the level that he did in the regular season. It really does come down to, is he ready to be that co-star? I think, like, you need a second guy. To me, Chet is an awesome player. He's incredible defensively. He's capable of getting hot offensively as a shooter, attacking closeouts and all that. But he's not a guy you give the ball to and say, hey, go get a bucket, dude, or generate offense over and over, possession after possession for you. J-Dub is the guy who shows the signs of doing that, but he's still just a young player. Mm-hmm. He's in his third year. I mean, it's a lot to expect. It sort of reminds me of like the Celtics years ago with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown being too young. Mm. But now SGA's ready, but is Jaylen Williams ready? Okay. Like that to me, that's still the biggest question with Oklahoma City today. And like, it really just won't be answered until the postseason. But we did see a glimmer of what it's going to be like without him. Obviously, he's not in the game. He's out. He's sidelined. He's injured. But if he's not performing or he's sidelined, it's like, well, where's the other creators for OKC? Do they have enough attack points? Whereas you look at Cleveland, they can attack from anywhere. You look at Boston, they have a bunch of different guys who can go off. I mean, they had a game with Peyton Pritchard and Derek White, both scoring over 40 points. They have so many guys who can do that. OKC, it's SGA and Jalen Williams, but do you need Jalen Williams to be that guy in the postseason?
Well, I mean, I think for OKC, it's depth, it's strength by numbers, and it's hoping that our style of play can generate the type of shots we need for these guys to hit them.
Dominant defense too, right?
Yes, exactly that. So that they're going to have to kind of figure that portion out. Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
Do you feel better or worse about Denver right now?
I mean, I had Denver fourth in my championship power rankings a couple weeks ago, which might have been a little too high because they've lost games since then, a lot of games since then. But I still love what they can be. Like you mentioned, we kind of forget what their ceiling is. Jokic is the best player in the world still, I think, in my opinion. You know, he might not win MVP, but he can still be the best player in the world. Westbrook has worked with them. I've been a Russ skeptic. He's helped answer a lot of those questions. Of course, he needs to do it in the postseason, but Murray has trended up. MPJ has had some down weeks. He was a reminder on Monday what he's capable of doing when he's feeling it. Zeke Nnaji did not, you know, play a lot on Monday, only 11 minutes, but he's somehow transformed himself from one of the worst rotation guys in the league to taking advantage of these minutes without Aaron Gordon and looking really good next to Jokic, like a lot of people do. Jalen Pickett, dude. I mean, like, Denver's depth, sometimes it looks good. Sometimes it looks good. Jalen Pickett looked great on Monday. So I still can't quit Denver. Do you feel the same?
There's a belief there. I think for me, it's just, what's the defense going to look like? You know, we get to these moments with Denver, and if you've watched enough Denver, you can notice in the first few minutes of the game, oh, they are not rotating tonight. This is going to be a tough one for them. Or
why does that happen, you think? Like, why do they have those moments where they just don't?
It's just
the intensity, focus isn't there. Is that a Malone thing?
I don't think it's a Malone thing, because if it was, he wouldn't be so furious every time it happens. You know, I think it's just, you can tell, like, for some reason, like, they put two on the ball and they see the rotation and they're not there and they're behind like 4 seconds. It's like, oh, this is going to be one of those nights. Like, Boston just carved them up the whole first quarter when they played. And I was like, okay, I understand. But when they're locked in, like, actually, against this OKC team, when they were doubling Shea and rotating behind and nailing the second rotations. When they have that defense going, that gives them the real big chance because now they can get in transition. They get Jokic in the half court. They're really good. I think it's just that might have more of an impact in the playoffs. I think that's always been one of my beliefs. Some of these teams you have question marks with defensively in the regular season. In the playoffs, they'll have a game plan. And they'll have a specific focus on what they're trying to take away. Never underestimate what that does for a team defense.
Do you? There's a lot of people on social media and whatnot who say, oh, nobody fears the top seeds in the West. You know, Golden State, don't fear them. If you fall down the standings, it's okay. Do you think people underestimate how much OKC and Denver should be feared at the top of the West right now?
Yes. Well, I mean, because here's the thing. If you're one of those bottom seeds, you're not supposed to fear Oklahoma City or Denver. But that doesn't mean that if you are working on the playoff game plan, you are not stressed out about what OKC and Denver can do to your team. That's just part of the playoffs. That's part of the madness. You're thinking about how to take Shea away. You're thinking about what to do with Jokic. How do you want to handle Jamal Murray? How to handle them in the fourth quarter? Like, there's a lot of things that go into it. So the whole, we don't need to fear them. It sounds really good, but it's not accurate. You have to prepare for these teams because you're going to have to take something away from them. I think the thing that people got to remember about the playoffs is it's about presenting a team with a very specific issue and forcing them to solve that issue in a short amount of time. If you are the team that is not as good or lower ranked or however you want to put it, you have to create something that makes this better team struggle. Can I get OKC into a tough spot? Can I get Denver's defense struggling? Can I put Jamal Murray in a box? Is Jalen Williams struggling? Okay. Now they have to figure that part out, just like OKC had to do with Dallas. Okay, these are the shots that we're getting. Are we making them? Oh, no. You know, that's kind of the dynamic of the playoffs. So, yes, there's a very healthy, respectful, competitive fear in when it comes to the playoffs.
With the MVP race, I conducted an experiment the last 3-4 days, Steve.
Okay.
Over on X, I posted the same poll in three separate days. Who's the NBA MVP, SGA or Jokic? After Jokic had his 30-20-20 game on Friday, I put it up there. Jokic had 53.9% of 25,000 votes. And then I did it after the Thunder won on Sunday. Who's the NBA MVP? SGA had 54.5% of 18,000 votes. And then I put it up again on Monday after the Nuggets won the second game of that series. Jokic currently 59.2% of those votes. It has flipped each day on social media. I know there's probably more Nuggets fans on wins on nights where they win and then more Thunder fans on nights, but it's a good sample size. 25K, 18,000, now currently 15K on the third one. Do you think that this could be an indicator of how close the race really is, or do you still buy SGA being quite heavy as the favorite to the Vegas betting odds on BetMGM and the straw polls that Tim Bontemps conducts over at ESPN? How close is the race to you, Steve?
I think it's close. I still think probably Shea is ahead, but I think it's close because I've said this every, like, the last 2-3 years. I don't think this is a Jokic MVP year unless he does X, Y, and Z. And then every single year, he does X, Y, and Z to put himself in that conversation. And so he has the impact numbers. He has Denver winning. But I think it all depends on, like, everyone has their different subjective tiebreakers to a degree. So for me, I just think this OKC season with what Shea has done, I don't know if he'll ever do it again and if they are this without him. You know, now I could say the same exact thing for Jokic because he's been insane all year. But I mean, this is an OKC team that's won, what, 80% of games? Like, that's not an easy thing to do in this league, especially when you are the focal point.
A reminder to give the Kevin O'Connor Show a thumbs up on YouTube and subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. And follow Steve Jones at SteveJones20 over on social media. We'll be right back. Okay, Steve, the Grizzlies, they beat the Suns on Monday, 120-118 over the Phoenix Suns. Good win for Memphis. Phoenix, I mean, we'll talk about them in a minute. They're still struggling to get back into the 10 spot. You got Kevin Durant getting jawed at the end of the game by Desmond Bane and Cam Spencer. And it's fun stuff, fun to watch. I want to talk about the Grizzlies offense because I want to get your thoughts on them. They have a season low in handoffs and pick and rolls run per game this season. Thinking Basketball made a really great video about them way back, I think, in December, about how they're an outlier historically in the tracking data era with the small amount of handoffs and pick and rolls that they run. There's been, you know, talk among Grizzlies circles recently about Ja's fit within this offense, lower numbers from him this season. Had a good game against Phoenix. But, you know, I am curious, Steve, you know, Ja's 29 points on 13 shots. How do you assess this Grizzlies offense, which has been stellar, but how do you assess what it can become postseason time in the context of what Ja Morant will need to be?
Well, I think the one thing with Memphis's offense, you have to realize it's about the space. The space they can create for each other, the space they can create for Ja Morant. I think this stretch without Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to show a little bit more of what Ja can do within it than maybe you had thought. I think it was important for Memphis to have a better flow and a better tempo and more for the totality of their team. You know, this is a team that had Ja, but in the half court, things could get real slow. Other guys maybe couldn't perform at the same level because they're not Ja Morant. You know, you had Desmond Bane, you had Jaren, but like, what do you have for the bench guys? So they have more comfort pushing and attacking in space and getting in a flow and getting a driving kick and cutting. So the number one thing I say is look at the cutting. You know, when you watch, especially the last few games, Ja Morant in action, when he's in pick and roll, someone is moving somewhere, whether they're in the corner, whether they're at the wing, they're relocating to create more space for Ja. And that's huge. I think a lot of, you got to remember, these are driving lanes for Ja Morant. So if they're running a play for Desmond Bane, he's just getting a wide pin down and you're locked in on that, that's room for Ja Morant to attack. So it may not always be traditional pick and roll, but they have Ja Morant. They're going to run pick and roll at some point. They're just going to have to.
I mean, we're seeing the uptick right now. And last five games, he's averaging 29 pick and rolls per game. He was at 18 for the entire season prior to this recent stretch. And 18 is, I mean, he had 35 last year. He's been over 30 pick and rolls per game every single season of his career. And so basically halved it, you know, to 18 for basically the entire season. But it's like, at one point it was at 15, at one point it was 16. It's like slightly ticked up and up and up, and you know, nearly 30 the last five games. I feel like we're at that point where I think you nailed it, Steve. We're seeing that blend where there's movement while pick and rolls are happening. And that's where I think this Grizzlies offense has been building towards this. My understanding is like this is something they decided to stall early in the season. It worked really well. Ja may have had some hiccups with it, but obviously you're going to run pick and roll. It's going to happen in the playoffs. Things slow down. It's inevitable. Like, you know, you're going to go to Ja high pick and roll at some point. And we're kind of at that point without Jaren Jackson Jr. where they have to run more of it.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is Ja's kind of had a season where he's looking for the curveball. You know, he's looking for the other pitches that he can have. You know, I think he had a big bucket against Phoenix where I'm getting to a spot and it's like a floater pull up and I'm trying to figure out what are these other options outside of me going 90 miles per hour in the paint all the time. We're seeing more catch and shoot threes to a degree. Like, we're just seeing different things. But I think if you're Memphis, you would take feeling better about a lot of your roster offensively and knowing you can get Ja going at some point and knowing Jaren Jackson Jr. is taking advantage of the space as well, by the way. Like, I know he's out, but he has looked to just drive and hit anyone in the face as many times as possible. So you take that totality and hope you can fine tune it in the playoffs. So that's going to be interesting to me. I just think what happens on the nights where they can't get the drives going, what happens on the nights where teams just say, you know what, we're just going to take Ja's drives away and kick all you want, shoot all you want. Like OKC said, no, thank you. No paint for you. What does that look like for them in the playoff context?
Yeah. And that's why ultimately I don't quite see them as a threat against OKC or is a threat against Denver in a playoff series. They're closer, but like Ja this year has just, whether it's the system or whether it's the shoulder issue that he talked about recently that doesn't seem to be going away, Ja is just not that level yet. Maybe he gets there, but he hasn't been yet where it's like, okay, Ja can elevate to the level where he's the best player in a postseason series. I mean, Jaren Jackson Jr. has been the better Grizzly this year. It's just the reality of it. So, like, unless Ja can elevate to that level, I can't trust them in a postseason series yet.
It gets fascinating because for me, it's like, where do they go? If they're like a three seed, does their path look different? Do you feel better about them against Denver, or do they end up in a tougher first round series? I don't know.
I mean, I don't want to face Denver. I don't want to face Denver and Jokic. I mean, maybe you'd be better off sliding down to the 4 or 5, but then what if the Warriors get up to the 5? Or what if, you know, I don't know how the seeding's going to work out, but that'd be a really tough first round series too, with Golden State playing at the level they are. But then it was getting it, like, the Grizzlies lost to Golden State in the past. It would be kind of cool for them. Now they're better, they're older, more mature. Go slay the Warriors in the first round. But maybe that's not time for that yet for Memphis. And then for Phoenix, they're the 11 seed right now, still 2.5 back from the 10 seed. Dallas won on Monday. The Suns lost again. They're 4-6 in their last 10 games. Like I said earlier, KD getting jawed at the end of the game by Cam Spencer and Desmond Bain and him going face to face. I don't know with Phoenix, man. I thought for sure they were going to be able to catch Dallas. I thought it was going to happen. That doesn't mean anything. I still think they'd lose in the first round. But do you see any indicators for Phoenix that any indicators of belief with the Suns, Steve?
The fact they have Kevin Durant and Devin Booker.
That's about it.
I'll be honest. I feel like I've been a Phoenix Suns truther during this run, trying to explain how it could work and what it could do, and fighting the good fight against people who said they need a real point guard and all this good stuff. And then you had the start of this year where everything looked really good, and then they just stopped playing defense. And then I've never, like, it gave me the ick. I've never been able to unsee it. They don't guard anyone. They don't do anything defensively. We can be honest. No disrespect.
Is that a Bud thing?
I don't know. I don't know where it is. They were active. They were fighting. They were rotating. And then it just stopped. And I'm like, why did it stop? And then offensively, why is it slow? Why are we not using the movement for KD, for Devin Booker? Why are teams not in rotation against you? Like, why?
I think that's a KD Book thing, because I was there, not the beginning of the season, but the beginning of last season with Vogel. And I talked with Vogel before the season. And he's like, we want to play fast, free flowing. And like, he's like, we're doing that right now in training camp, and we're moving, and it's going to look, and he's just feeling good about their own system and what it's going to be. And then the season, they play slow. And then this year, new coach, Mike Budenholzer, coming in, playing slow, very slow. I'd imagine that's a player thing more so than a coach thing. That's my impression.
It's upsetting either way. I'm not happy about it. We've got the ghosts of Dallas pass in the plane.
It's ugly to watch. And with their defense, look, Suns fans have come at me recently because Kevin Durant's opponent field goal percentage on defense, he's like top five in the league, opponent field goal percentage. KD's not peak KD either on defense, despite what the numbers may say. He's not that guy who can play the five and dominate like he did for the Golden State Warriors, winning two finals MVPs. He's not quite peak defensive version of himself either. So I think that's a component of their defense not being what they envisioned or hoped that it would be as well.
The problem is, he can only do so much when he's in rotation, or he can only do so much from the weak side, and he can only do so much when he's on ball. Eventually, someone else is going to have to be involved, and they're going to put a big and pick and roll, and what are your rotations going to look like? And is that next man going to keep the ball in front? And I haven't felt them be connected on defense in a very long time. Like, I feel offenses feel comfortable doing what they want against them. And if they want to make this plan, they got to change that. I think if they can, they can defend, they can at least do something. We saw it against the Clippers.
Sure. but like, even if they make the play-in, it's not going to last long, Steve. What? It's not going to last long.
No belief.
They get the 10 seed, they probably lose in the play-in. And if they don't lose in the play-in, they're going to probably get killed by OKC in the first round.
So this is it. It's over. It's over for the Phoenix Suns.
I think it's over. I mean, I had John Gambadaro, Gambo, great Suns, a reporter, radio guy based in Arizona. And, he said that this is going to be the last run. They're not going to be in the luxury tax again next year, or over the second apron, rather, next season. Days later, Wintour's reported this could be it for KD as well. So, yeah, I think, on a local level, their best local, source guy is reporting that. On a national level, that's being reported. Shams, of course, at the deadline was all on top of the KD stuff. So, yeah, I think local, national, what I'm personally been hearing about the KD stuff, like, I think it's over, Steve. I think this is it. Well, this is it.
I have no debate. I have nothing for you. That's it.
It's sad. It is sad, though. I mean, I hope they get into the play-in and make a real effort, because Dallas without Kyrie and possibly without AD, I don't want to see them in a play-in. I don't want to see that. I want to see the Suns fighting for their lives after going through this insanely hard schedule to end the season. That would be fun.
You don't want to see, you want to see Brandon Williams and Klay Thompson?
No,
not at all.
I don't want to see Klay Thompson dribbling the clock out.
Max Christie, a little Najee Marshall drive.
I'm a big PJ Washington guy. He had some big scoring games in Charlotte. Get him going. So I don't know. I don't want to see Dallas. I want to see Warriors KD. I'm sorry, not Suns KD. mixing things up. Let's talk about a team that's winning a lot. The Cavaliers. They have won 14 times in a row. This is the third time this season they have a win streak of 10 plus games in a single season. Pretty historic stuff what they're doing. How long could this streak go is one of the questions on my mind, because Cleveland's upcoming schedule, Steve. Oh, my. They have Brooklyn on Tuesday, Memphis Friday, Orlando, Clippers, Kings, Suns, Jazz, Blazers, Spurs, Pistons, Clippers. That's their remaining schedule through the month of March. Some tough games in there, but a hell of a lot of winnable games in there. It just feels like when you think Cleveland might have peaked too early, now they're peaking again. I feel like this team is getting better over the course of the season.
They're very good. I think that's they're a machine on both ends of the floor. I think that's one of the things that Kenny Atkinson has done is given this team belief. He believes in their depth, and offensively, they will attack you in multiple ways. And it's hard to kind of keep them in a box because they use their guys in different ways. I think this is why you needed the growth from Darius Garland, why you needed the growth from Evan Mobley, where Evan Mobley is now someone you can use in so many different ways. He can grab and go and bring the ball up the court and get involved in dribble handoffs and run inverted pick and roll for him. Donovan Mitchell has been lights out, I think, to a degree that maybe people don't understand because he hasn't had to play as much because this team has been so good. But the way that he's operated in pick and roll, Darius Garland being aggressive and the things they do offensively to just keep pressure on defenses is the number one thing I would say to people. Like, you've got to watch that they will keep pressure on you. When they played Milwaukee, I felt bad for Milwaukee. Milwaukee had the effort in mind, but the ball is faster than the man. And that's what Cleveland does. They're always going to find a way to keep you in rotation and keep pressure on you. And they just play with such a belief now, you know? It's not, hey, can these guys guard? They're willing to switch Mitchell, Garland, Allen this year and trust their team defense. DeAndre Hunter fits right into what they want to do. So they have lineup versatility with Strus, with Hunter, with Okoro at times. Like, they can mix and match to kind of have that versatility that can get you through the playoffs. So it's just been so much fun to watch them kind of grow throughout the season. I think the win against Boston, obviously a little bit of old news, but like, that's a stamp for a team like Cleveland. Like, I think they've had a few moments. You talk about them peaking again. I think they have moments where they understand how far they've come. And that reignites that belief. And so that's been fun to watch. And that's one of the reasons they had the season they've had.
I mean, that game happened last week, as you said, but still it is a relevant kind of data point with that Cleveland-Boston potential Eastern Conference Finals later this year. Mitchell had 41 in that game. He's averaging well over 30 points in each game against the Celtics this season. It feels like Donovan Mitchell gets whatever shot he wants against this great Celtics defense. And that feels relevant to me, even though it's the regular season. Like, Donovan Mitchell is playing the best basketball of his entire career. He's had postseason success as well back in Utah. So it's not like this guy is going in, you know, with zero experience. Mitchell could be the best player in a postseason series for sure. He's been excellent this season, and him doing against Boston matters a lot. With that said, you did mention how Garland and Mitchell, the Cavs, are willing to switch them this season and trust their team defense. That probably will be the biggest concern. Like, if you're power ranking your concerns for the Cavaliers, is it teams targeting Mitchell and Garland at number one for you in the postseason?
I would probably say number two.
Number two.
Number okay. one is, can we make Evan Mobley have a tough time scoring the basketball?
Okay. Why is that? Why is that number one?
As important as Evan Mobley has been, if a team has a matchup where they feel like they can switch him, or, you know, they feel like they can put a wing on him, or they don't have to double and he's having a tough time scoring the basketball, that changes the dynamic for Cleveland's offense a little bit. So for me, it's always in the back of my mind, is it Mobley or is it Garland? You know, if I'm sitting down with a Polo on and I want to take one of these two away, is it Darius Garland, you are going to have to make shots and make plays. Or is it Evan Mobley, we can make you have a tough time, you know? So your drives aren't as impactful because we're staying at home. We feel comfortable just kind of contesting and letting that happen. That's where my mind goes. I think the Mitchell Garland thing is important. One, because of the volume of they're going to be put in action. Like, it's just like we get to this part of spring, we see more game plan things happen in these matchups, but they're going to be put in pick and roll. They're going to have to switch, they're going to have to defend and hold up, which they've done. But how, when do they blink is my question. And I'd also put low-key Jared Allen in that group. So if we're listing concerns, will those three hold up in those switches? Cleveland's done a good job of keeping their belief, but will they have to make an adjustment to say, okay, we're going to switch or do this, or we're not going to switch? That's where it's like, I just want to see it, to see exactly what it was. I mean, it's not necessarily like, hey, they can't do it, so they can't win a championship, but it's more like, okay, which team is going to poke at it? Like, is it Milwaukee? Is it Boston, obviously? Like, but I don't think it holds them back.
I think with Cleveland, like, you know, for Cavs fans, including our producer, Mike Goldfarb, he's like, dude, they're 54-10. How are you listing concerns? Well, I mean, yeah, like, it's concerns for, you know, just there's always concerns. Every team, there's always concerns. So I think with Cleveland, those are fair. They are fair concerns. Now, will they hold them back from winning the title or at least getting to the NBA Finals? Maybe not. But it does feel like they're building towards this postseason run. As much as they're switching this season, they're one of the, I believe, top 10 switch rate teams in the NBA this year. They're clearly building towards that, trusting that, because they know they'll have to switch in the postseason. But successfully doing in the postseason is another question. When you do have two smaller guards and teams are going to attack them, and then when they're attacking them over and over, possession after possession, how does that impact them offensively as well when their energy is getting drained on one end? That is also a possibility, and that would matter more if they don't have Evan Mobley to turn to, like you're saying, offensively. So it's like kind of a combination of those things. I will say, though, with Cleveland, I feel offensively they do a lot of what Boston did last year with their high three-point rate. Like, the results of their offense is a ton of threes and a ton of made threes. But they get theirs in so many different ways. They have so many different layers to their offense. Like, sometimes they look like the Beautiful Game Spurs with their passing. Like, I feel like they have a lot of different they can pull different levers with their offense, which is why I feel so optimistic about their chances.
No, I'm right there with you. I mean, they make so many good quick decisions, and they force you to, like, guard a second action. As soon as you defend the first thing well, now the ball's moving from side to side. So you've got to keep defending, keep defending, keep defending, keep closing out, keep recovering. And, like, that's been the fun. Like, as much as you want to talk about Evan Mobley, he's driving more from the perimeter. So, like, he's making shots, but he's driving. So you now catch and drive, and now you help. It's a dump off to Jared Allen. Like, they just find a way to keep you in rotation. And, like, I think that's been such a key part for Cleveland this year. And that it's belief. They have belief.
Are you surprised by how much a team can just transform their identity in 1 year? They get rid of J.B. Bickerstaff, who's been awesome, you know, helping build the Pistons this year. They bring in Kenny Atkinson. It's like some changes to the roster, but system-wise, it's just so dramatically different. Like, from a coaching standpoint, how surprised are you at how much things have been transformed?
Oh, I mean, for me, I've been higher on Cleveland than most. For me, it was just tempo. If they could fix the tempo thing, I think there was so much, like, within that team they could get done. I think the biggest thing for me with Kenny Atkinson is he got the buy-in, he got the belief, and then he got the success. So you got this team to buy in. Like, I remember early in the season, he was talking about how much depth this team had. And he truly believed in that depth because he played all these guys. And they all felt like they had a role, and it's paid off over the course of the season. So now they have an understanding of what they're supposed to do offensively. They flow. They have tempo. They get up and down. We have success with it. Oh, let's keep doing this. Now defensively, we feel good about this. Like, they have an understanding of who they are. And I think that's where I give him the credit, is he got that buy-in, that belief. And whenever a team has success, they're going to go ahead and continue to do that. You know, I think that's why when teams have these runs, it's like, you got to remember, the coach got the buy-in, the players believe in what they're doing. If they're going to start winning games, like, if you're surprised by Golden State, no, they believe that they're this good. So now they're playing at a high level as opposed to before, you know, never underrate the belief.
You got to believe. You got to believe. It's an old 04 Red Sox. You got to believe. Old thing from 21 years ago. You know, one other thing on Cleveland. I think it's interesting they made a trade. They made a trade despite being on top. Despite being the number one seed, by far best statistically in the East and all that, they still made a trade. And juxtapose that against OKC. They made a minor trade last year. They felt like it messed with chemistry a little bit. They didn't make a trade this year. They could have traded for Cam Johnson, or really OKC could have traded for anybody with their amount of first round draft picks. Anybody they want, they could have had that player. They didn't make a trade. And so you have one team at the top of their conference decided we're going to stick with what we have in the name of chemistry. You have another team that said we're going to make a trade to improve our chances. And, you know, the team will deal with it because we believe in our chemistry so much. I think one of the differences there is OKC being very young team, college vibes, big group interviews after the games and all that. Cleveland does have more veterans. So I'm sure that might be part of it. But I'm a believer in this team, man. And I love the fact they made that trade because Hunter adds so many layers to that team as well.
I think his defense and his drive has been really good for Cleveland. And, like, that says that we want to go for it now. Like, we would like to have this lineup that we can go for this now. We can play a little smaller at times when we have one of these two good bigs on the court. I like the move. That he's been really good for them.
Yeah, he's been excellent. And you mentioned which teams can poke at Cleveland in the postseason. So far in the regular season, it has not been the Bucks. They are now 0-4 against the Cavaliers during the regular season. They're also 0-3 against the Celtics, and they're 0-2 against the Knicks. Those are the three teams ahead of them in the standings right now. That's not a good sign for Milwaukee. It's not a good sign that you are 0-2 versus the Knicks, 0-3 versus Celtics, 0-4 versus the Cavaliers. Why are the Bucks not on the same level as those teams, Steve?
Consistency defensively, I think for me, is probably the number one thing. I think Giannis has had an incredible season, but defensively, can they find that consistency on that end of the floor where we feel good about our rotations? Brooks in a drop, we don't have the same screen navigators, we don't have the same size, we're struggling with certain matchups, we're struggling with closeouts. Like, they just have a rotating series of issues defensively to me sometimes. I think that's one of the worst places you can live in. Especially against these specific matchups, because, okay, do you want to switch Brook? They'll switch Brook a little bit more. That's fine. You want Brook in a drop? Is he recovering? Giannis on the weak side has done some really good things defensively this year. But now if he has to rotate and close back out, who's helping him? Like, I think it's those kind of just minor defensive issues against these specific teams, especially the Cavs and the Celtics. You have to be lights out defensively against these teams. And so they've got to hit that high level. Maybe they'll achieve it in the playoffs. Who knows? But, and then offensively, I just think it's their pace slows against these type of teams. They're in the half court. It's a little slower than they want to be. When they have pace and tempo, when they're moving the ball side to side, they're pretty good. I think we get tough.
Is that a Giannis thing? Is that on Giannis a bit?
I think it's just on the Dame searches for it, Giannis searches for it, and they have to set them up. So, and I think it's just a half court thing for them, because that's why they have to get stops to be able to kind of do some of the more run things, right? But if they're constantly kicking the ball at the net, okay, now we have to set this up.
Mr. Run and Jump?
Yeah. Oh, no. No, check the mid-range stats. Don't you dare.
I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm kidding. Thank you. I had Drew Hanlon on my pod a few weeks ago. We talked all about the mid-range stuff and how Giannis has improved there. Giannis has been awesome for mid-range. I just kid.
No, I
don't. The run and jump thing.
But it's one of those deals where, like, they have to find that in the playoffs. So I think that's one thing that's holding them back, and specifically against those two teams.
Yeah, exactly. The Knicks, I mean, we'll see. I think the Bucks could beat the Knicks in a playoff series if the seeding somehow worked out that way. But Celtics, Cavs, I would not take them over either of those teams. I mean, the Kuzma addition, we talk about defense. He has flipped the switch from what, you know, Wizards, I mean, one of the worst seasons of his entire career for the worst team he's played on his entire career. But he's been way better defensively with the Bucks since he got there. So if you're looking for reasons for optimism for the Bucks to collectively flip that switch, I think the ability to have lineup versatility with Kuzma, you could play with Giannis at the five if necessary in certain spurts. It's the Kuzma addition with how he changes the complexion of that team. But I still have those same concerns, Steve, like defensive consistency and then offense, they just get stuck in the mud far too often. But the Kuzma addition at least changes the options Doc Rivers will have lineup wise with flexibility that he'll have come postseason.
I will say the Dame Giannis chemistry has been better. So I will say that to the people. The Dame knows when to get that ball to him. Giannis knows how to roll. They like have really punished teams. And like we've seen high pick and roll where, oh, we actually have to make a decision. And that's positive. So, I mean, a lot of their run is going to be those two being absolute demons, if we're being honest.
For sure. And I mean, and ultimately, you know, postseason is different. It is different. Like Giannis, he talked about openly, you know, Drew Hanlon said to me in the pod that Giannis wanted to, you know, improve the mid-range jumper so he could just be less reckless on drives to the rim come, you know, throughout the regular season, be more durable so he's healthy again come postseason time. Giannis spoke about that in an ESPN article this week. He's like, yeah, I want to be able to be healthy. I want another layer to my game. And I want to be able to have that weapon. I know as I age, I might have only 5 more years of playing at my peak. And I need to sustain success. And so I think, you know, for Giannis, he has that new weapon for the postseason. And he's going to be turning it up to another level, playing more minutes. He's currently, hopefully, knock on wood, he's able to stay healthy entering the postseason for the first time in a couple years now. He's still one of the best players in the world. He could be the best player on any night at all. And Damian Lillard, we know what he can do on the biggest stage. And so maybe the Bucks are one of those teams that can flip a switch. I wouldn't rule them out as a team that maybe could upset their way to the finals, but I wouldn't take them in a series over Cleveland or Boston. I don't love their odds. I think this team has too many flaws. We talk about the depth Cleveland has, the depth Boston has. Those teams have nailed some of their draft picks, some of their moves around the edges. OKC has done the same thing in the Western Conference side. Milwaukee has missed time after time after time in the draft, and I think that's one of the reasons why they don't have depth, why it doesn't feel like they have a full roster. And that's really why I can't take them seriously as a true finals threat, even though I'm not going to entirely rule them out. They just don't have the weapons behind those guys.
Well, I mean, fast forward to Giannis hitting 5 fadeaways and winning game one.
Yeah. It's very possible. Very possible. I'll have you on again after that show. We'll take a quick break again, and we'll be right back to talk more NBA. All right, Steve. So the biggest news over the weekend was LeBron James had a groin injury, and he'll be out for 1 to 2 weeks. I was at this game in Boston, and like sitting in the media section, it was kind of weird because, you know, LeBron, he got back to the other end of the floor, and then he just kind of stood there through the whole time out. He just stood in place, and everybody on the Lakers kind of went and huddled around him. And I was sitting next to Jared Weiss from The Athletic, and we're like, is LeBron hurt? He's not moving. He's just like standing there kind of like a statue. And then he started walking to the locker room. You know, people start posting on social about what's happening, and boom, we find out shortly after that he has a groin issue and he could be out for multiple weeks. And then they lose on Monday without LeBron to the Brooklyn Nets. Rough start for the Lakers in their post-LeBron or regular season era right here. Their upcoming schedule is really tough as well. They get the Bucks, Nuggets, Suns, Spurs, Nuggets, Bucks again at the end of that. What's your feeling about the Lakers this upcoming stretch minus LeBron, Steve?
I mean, it's a bummer because of what they were building and what we were kind of watching as Luka and LeBron were playing together. I think it's going to be interesting to see what lineups they want to go with and how do they handle teams saying, hey, Luka Doncic, here's two on the ball in every single possible way. Because I think that was one of the question marks I had watching them early is, okay, when teams decide to trap Luka, what's this look like for the Lakers? Because you have to find a rhythm as far as when to roll, how to spray the ball out to the perimeter, who's taking the shots where, what's the spacing look like, can we keep an advantage, those type of things. So this is going to be good reps for them, but it's also going to be a consistent theme that I think they'll see during the stretch as far as like either switching or two on the ball, and they're going to have to find ways to make plays. So can they kind of keep that compete level defensively without LeBron? Because, I mean, yes, LeBron is LeBron, but at the same time, he was kind of like a monster on the weak side during this stretch as far as his activity because he had more juice because Luka was there. So can they now put those lineups out there that still have some of that defensive level? Or if you're going to have like Connect, Vincent, Reeves out there, how are teams going to attack them plus Luka? You know, like, what are the combinations that unlock what you do? So I think that's probably where I'm looking at. Can you find the right combos? And then offensively, can you just kind of get used to this two on the ball type beat?
For sure. I mean, I think that's spot on. And we kind of saw Saturday, even prior to the LeBron injury, no Rui Hachimura, no Jackson Hayes in that game. It feels like if you take just one or two pieces out of this Lakers team, like, Rui's important defensively with his size as well. Jackson Hayes with his activity, and then also on offense, like, his kind of connective passing. Like, he's been good. Jackson Hayes has been really solid for them. So, like, if they feel thin just removing one piece, never mind if you remove a piece as gigantic as LeBron James with how dominant he's been on both ends of the floor in recent weeks. With Luka, it's going to be interesting because if you look purely at the numbers, Data Baller, their stat line shift stats, Luka per 75 possessions without LeBron James averaging 36 points, 11 assists, 12 rebounds, shooting only 29% from three, but like, those are monster numbers. 36, 12, and 11. Now, doing that when you're game planning against Luka exclusively, I do expect, like you said, we're going to see two on the ball a hell of a lot. Is there anything that could be beneficial here for the Lakers during the stretch, facing these types of defenses, Luka getting thrown out there, being the higher usage guy without having LeBron James as kind of that, you know, 1B player initiating offense? Is there any positives here, or is this all negative considering they were still building the Luka-LeBron unit together?
Positives is Luka will, you know, they were trying to integrate him. Now Luka's got to go out there and be Luka. So that's a positive. I think Austin Reeves, you also have to go out there and play. I think there's a chance for a guy like Gabe Vincent to get going during a stretch like this. I think he's someone
who's good on Monday.
Secretly important. Like, if he's making shots, I think that helps a lot. So I think it's more just getting reps, guys getting comfortable, guys staying aggressive. Because, you know, whenever LeBron does come back, this is pretty simple. We can, he's LeBron James, we have Luka, but it's now kind of building up the Luka part of it, and then maybe having some more things for Austin Reeves, maybe getting some more movement, potentially, some of the things that J.J. Redick may want that team to run when those guys aren't out there, like, opportunity to kind of, improve overall. So I always look at injuries as bad, but they're always repetitions to kind of get better.
Well, I'm sure Adam Silver is absolutely praying to the basketball gods and David Stern that the Lakers fall to the 4 or 5 seed and the Warriors move up to the 4 or 5 seed. That's what I'm sure they're hoping for. I bet they're hoping that for that silver line and get a first round series between LeBron James and Stephen Curry. And maybe we get that because, you know, you got Amen Thompson out for the Rockets right now. They've lost 11 of their last 19 games. They are currently the 5 seed, only 3 games ahead of the Warriors. Like, there's a chance. There's a chance we do get Lakers Warriors in the first round. There's a chance. So good for Adam Silver.
That sound you hear is Memphis and Houston fans yelling at their screen right now.
Well, Memphis could move up to 3.
There we go.
Memphis to 3. Memphis to 3. And then Lakers to 4. Warriors to 5. Rockets to 6. That's possible.
There we go.
Yeah, that could happen. Who would you pick in that series, Lakers or Warriors? Both healthy.
Both healthy? I'm probably leaning Lakers right now. With the defense showed and the lineups that they can do. Like, but Golden State is – my indicator with Golden State is, what is Draymond doing defensively? Is he jumping people? And then does he jump in the air after he passes? That's when you know that Draymond Green is enjoying playing basketball. And he did it like 4 times yesterday. So Golden State's pretty good, man.
That's a good way to put it. that would be a hell of a series if we do end up getting it, whether it's the 3-6 or the 4-5. That would be really cool to see. Let's close today's podcast with a rookie report, Steve. Well, I want to talk about the French guys. Zachary Risacher, let's start out with him. He was the number one pick in the NBA this season, averaging 11.7 points, 3.6 rebounds, and 24.4 minutes per game. BetMGM has him 3rd in rookie of the year odds right now. He's played excellent defense this season. My big question coming into the year with him, my big question prior to the draft with him was, how good is Richesse's jumper really? Because last season playing overseas, he started the year, first 30 or so games, shooting nearly 50% from three. He was lights out. This followed a career professionally where he was below 30% from three. Then he finished the year overseas, the last half of the year, below 30% from three. I was more of the belief that, hey, I think this guy has a shot that looks good. It just doesn't fall enough. 70% free throw guy consistently throughout his career. I didn't have belief in him. This season with the Hawks has been a little different. His first 39 games, he shot 28.1% from three, aligned with what he's done historically. Only 71.3% from the free throw line, aligned with what he did historically. But his last 19 games, he's come to life, 46.1% from three, 70.3% from the free throw line. Again, still consistent there. He's surging. Hawks fans are killing me for Richesse. they're after me. They're like, what are you gonna tweet about him? What are you gonna talk about him on your pod? Here we are. We're doing it today. I look dumb the last 20 games. I do, but I still don't have total confidence. I need to see him sustain it for longer with the jumper because that's really important for him. We know he can do everything else. But what are your impressions of Richesse, Steve?
I mean, honestly, for me, it was the thing that stuck out to me was that there was just not a ton of hesitation from him, despite the percentages. He was very just aggressive, if you would, you know,
very confident.
There's no hesitation. I think that's important. That's a big quality.
High volume.
Yes.
High volume.
But that's huge if you're going to be someone that is looking to improve a certain part of your game. You got to just let it fly. I think that's a big part of it.
For what it's worth, this was Gavoni's argument with me. I had him on my draft pod last year. Gavoni's like, he shoots 4, 5, 6 threes a game. He's going to figure it out over time when he's not cramped up in, you know, little planes in the middle seat, you know, traveling overseas when he's got luxury and he's playing in his NBA strength and conditioning. He's going to figure it out. He's going to find consistency. So maybe we're seeing that. Just wanted to interject with that anecdote from Gavoni.
Oh, no, you're good. But I mean, I think for me, the willingness to drive is just as important. Like for him to be able to kind of make some of these plays, get some of these paint touches, I think that's just as key as being able to make those shots because you got to be able to have that mindset. And so the cutting, the driving, that's the stuff to me that I've enjoyed from him and watching him continue to do that. And like he can relocate, he can find the gaps. So I think the shot is to me the. It's like the topper. It's the ice cream on top for me. I think when he's making those shots now, you've got a really dangerous display. But when he's just getting downhill, that's the part I wasn't so sure he'd be able to do consistently. And I've liked it.
Yeah. It's looked good, man. I mean, like I said, with Richesse, all the role player stuff, versatile defense, size. He's 6'9", 6'10". He's focuses on defense. He brings the right mindset. I mean, like he's a really good defensive player, even as a rookie. If you're arguing for who the rookie of the year is come April, defense is going to be a strong argument for him. And then if he continues this offensively over the last, you know, month and change, that's going to strengthen his argument as well. Like what he did on Monday, he had 22 points on 16 shots, 8 boards. If he has a hell of a lot more games like that, it's going to really strengthen his argument against the current favorite, Stephon Castle. Now, with Richesse offensively, like you said, the downhill attacking has been good. His ball handling improved a lot last season overseas. He started the year not doing a lot. End of the season, he was doing more. He's doing like little Euros and sidesteps on drives. He can pass out of drives to Richesse. That's why, to me, the jumper is so important. Because if you're talking about like number one pick standards, like that's what I'm thinking about this as. Not just NBA player. Like I think he's going to be a quality NBA player, but by number one pick standards, it's vital that jumper becomes consistent. Like we see what he can do in these games where he's feeling it. He's a 30-point game this season, a bunch of 20-point games. When he's feeling it with a jumper, he becomes a completely different type of player for the Hawks in their long-term outlook versus, yeah, he does all the other stuff, but the jumper, eh. It's really streaky. It's not so good.
Do you feel better about the type of jumper he's getting? Do you feel better about the rhythm he has when he's getting to the jumper?
I mean, I think the jumper looks good. Mechanically, it looks good. I just worry about kind of like that the natural touch in the fingers. Like he's 70% from the line basically every season of his life that he's played. Like it's just pretty consistent there. Free throw, you know, statistically has always been a better historical indicator for future three-point shooting success than actual three-point percentage. And so that's where I look at and I'm like, well, he's 46.1% over his last 19 games from three. I hope for Hawks fans, this is going to be, you know, closer to 40% moving forward in his career, because then he's going to be probably rightfully the number one pick. You know, maybe it ends up Castle when we do these redrafts 5-10 years from now. But, you know, Risa Shea becoming a reliable shooter would make the Hawks feel really happy with their selection. But so for Hawks fans, it's really good to see what he's done over the last 19 games as a shooter, and then over the whole season with what he's done. I think he could win Rookie of the Year, but Castle's also been excellent for the Spurs as of late too. So that can end up close. Jalen Wells being second right now ahead of Risa Shea for in the BetMGM Rookie of the Year odds. I don't think that's quite right. I think Wells has been excellent this year, don't get me wrong, but I think when it comes to what voters will do, I'd be surprised if Risa Shea doesn't get more love come April.
Okay.
I'd be a little surprised there.
I'm intrigued.
The number two pick was another Frenchie, Alex Sarr. I'll tell you what, with Sarr, defensively we're seeing what he can potentially do. The Wizards still stink, but there's flashes of the defensive versatility, Steve. I feel like with Sarr, like, that's what you drafted him for. The offense, very slow to develop. He had 16 points on 19 shots on Monday night. The playmaking flashes are there, the connective passing ability. But you drafted him for his defense. What's your assessment of what he's done on the defensive end as an individual? Because the Wizards collectively, obviously, they stink.
I think the activity has been better for Alex Sarr defensively, to where he understands, okay, I need to be in a drop. I need to come back up to the level. I need to just make multiple efforts defensively. And for me, I want to see how that continues to grow. Like, hey, how much more can we get him to switch? Can we get him to be more of a monster on that end? What can he do when he's not involved in the action? Like, that's the fun for me. I personally, you know, non-defense division, I think he's gotten better at, like, pick and roll as far as understanding the angles and the timing on his roll and catching on the short roll and not immediately going 99 miles per hour. Like, I think that stuff's fun. But I think defensively, we've seen just kind of the growth from him to just know what I'm supposed to do. And, like, you feel – it feels more impactful to a degree as opposed to, boy, I hope I bought this shot, you know?
You mentioned the angles on some of his screening. Sarr's offense is one of the reasons why I bumped him down my board last year. I ended up having him at number six on my final rankings last year. And I don't have the stat in front of me, but like the at-rim finishing last year in Perth was not what you'd expect from a seven-footer, never mind the really shaky shooting with him. And we've seen more of that this year with the Wizards. He's just inefficient for basically every zone on the floor this season. The playmaking, like, he can handle, like, you can see him running DHOs and he can make the right pass out of the short roll. Like, I have no doubts about Sarr's passing and handling at his size. Like, that's a given to me. But the scoring, I still retain concern with what he's actually going to be capable of. On those finishes, if he's not a lob dunk finish, I don't trust his touch. I don't know, man. Like, I think they draft them number two again, considering their needs. But I got real concerns with his offense, man, especially when you look at who went number three in Stephon Castle. I think they'd still go Sarr again because of the size aspect, but man, like, that could end up being kind of a too big of a swing on size over what Castle's been doing for the Spurs right now.
Does his aggression offensively change it for you, or are we still looking at the inefficiency? Does the mindset do anything for you? Because he wants to be very good offensively.
I interviewed him last year, and like, he talked about like the transition attacking, how he wants to be like Giannis and all that, like going coast to coast. Mm. And it's like, yeah, you want to be, but you're like a twig in comparison to him. Like, you have to add a hell of a lot of muscle. So that's where it's like, over time, can he get strong, where maybe my lack of belief in his jumper doesn't matter because he becomes such a good downhill attacker and pick and roll and finishing at the rim. Because like you said, he wants to be. So maybe it's the type of thing where it's about strength and body developing over the course of time for him. But I, as a dynamic offensive, you know, creator, pull-up jumpers, you know, high percentage pull-up, spot-up threes, I don't think that's necessary for Sarr. I think he just needs to be what he can be at his peak level defensively, which is a high-end, switchable big who can offer some rim protection, and then offensively, connective piece, you know, downhill attacker, you know, slashing to the basket. If that's what he can be, and if you pair him with some primary creators, Sarr can be a really good player long term. And I feel like the Wizards are building something. You know, as bad as they are, I feel like something's there with what they're doing, but they really need some lottery luck, you know, come this May. Like if you add Cooper Flagg to that, I mean, that changes everything. Have you watched much Cooper this year?
A little bit. He's pretty good.
You got a lot on your plate, Steve. Yes. You do NBA and WNBA. Like adding college basketball on top of that would seem impossible.
No, so I'll do what I did when I worked in the NBA. I'll catch up during the tournament and get yelled at.
Exactly. Look, like for me, when it comes to the draft, all those games are up there on Synergy. It's like Netflix for me. I don't need to watch a game live in November. I can watch that game in March April or May. Like the game is still there. The intel gathering often happens after the season anyway for people even in the league sometimes. The last French guy I want to talk about here, Tijon Salon for the Charlotte Hornets. One of the rawest players to enter the NBA in years, and like that was a given prior to the season, and then this season, 19.1 minutes per game, 5.2 points per game, shooting 31.9% from the floor. He has proven that he is indeed one of the most raw players to enter the NBA in years, and he just got assigned to the G League. What have been your Salon impressions, Steve?
My thing is, you see the potential. I think with a player that's raw, you always look to see, okay, what could this be? I know it's not going to be that consistently. I know it's not necessarily going to do that. But what is the thing that you could bring to the table every single night? And so for me, it's mostly been like, hey, there's some threes. I didn't see energy. That coming. But hey, there's activity. You know, there's some drives. You know what I mean? Like, he's got like a bounce to him, which I enjoy. I always like a young player with a bounce to him. But I don't know. The tough part for him is going to be finding the one thing that he does every single night. Is that going to be defense? Is that going to be energy? Like, you need to crack a rotation, you need to have something where a coach would be like, okay, I know what I'm getting from you. We need this. Can you go do it for us? I don't know if that's going to be outside of maybe right now, which sounds bad, but he's thrown some, like, I've liked the drives sometimes.
You know, I mean, look, Charlotte taking him number 6 last year was, like, if you had said that in January or February or March that Salon goes 6, it would be a major shocker. You're like, wait a minute, what happened between now and then for him to go number 6? But I think for a team in Charlotte's position, I still appreciate the pick, even if it ends up wrong. He went ahead of Klingon at 7, Dillingham at 8, Edie at 9, Cody Williams, Manus Bouzelas. Like, you know, so a lot of those guys have not done a lot this season. You know, Edie has been good for Memphis, but I don't think he kind of fits what Charlotte wants to be right now. They had, at the time, Nick Richards and Mark Williams. They traded Mark Williams before getting him back. I don't think centers were in their plans at the time. Salon was that home run swing where they know they're going to be in the lottery for a couple more years. They hope only a couple more years, maybe longer. Salon was that big swing that, you know what, if he's a bust, okay, whatever. We're going to get more chances to take more safe players. And if he works out, great. Maybe he's a role player. Maybe he's a 3-and-D guy, an energetic, versatile defender, you know, who can finish at the rim and shoot reliable spot threes. And if he, since it's a big swing, maybe he becomes a star.
Mm.
Do you see any star upside with him, or do you see more just role player upside with Salon?
I think I see role player right now. And it's mainly just because, I mean, how to get him to be star, he would have to make a leap and he'd have to be used in such a way that I'm not sure we're going to see that yet, you know? So it's like, oh, is he going to play? Is he going to be a pick and roll person? He's going to be also off screen. He's going to be spaced. Like, I think he's going to be solid. You know what I mean? Solid, solid energy guy.
Last thing I want to touch with you, Steve, you know, we mentioned Cooper Flagg. There's the betting odds out there say that he's more likely to return to Duke than to play for the Hornets. I don't buy that he's, you know, more likely to return to Duke. However, I do I do wonder with NIL, there will be a day I think we'd see a projected number one pick decide to go back to school because the NIL money is just so significant that they'll say, you know what, I'll take some losses for 1 year in order to live a college life again and be the best player on my team by far, be a god on campus and go win another or maybe their first national championship. Don't you think NIL could like change the equation for a projected number one pick someday where at the least they use it as leverage more than we've ever seen to steer their way towards a certain team? Like they could just decide to go back and make $5 million instead of $12 million.
Whew, that had to be a very specific team in a very specific circumstance, I think, for it to go that way. But I think, could it happen? Yes. Would it happen? I'm not sure. Because the risk you run, and here's the part that no one's talking about. The person that does it, hypothetically, and it doesn't work out for them, but they have a worse second year, and they are now no longer the number one pick. What does that look like? Not, you know, not to say like, I'm not wishing anything bad on anyone. Yeah. Like, what does that scrutiny look like? Like you came back for the NIL money and you're averaging 12-6 after a great freshman year. You know what I mean?
Well, and for Cooper, let's just say he is seriously thinking about it. Like he's like, you know what? I'm dead ass. I'm gonna think about going back. I might have a second year at Duke. The thing for him this year is the 2026 draft has three number one quality players at the least. AJ DeBonta, who I had on my podcast last Friday, going to BYU, number one pick quality, 6'9" shot maker. You're gonna love him once you eventually get to watch DeBonta, Steve. Then Darren Peterson going to Kansas, 6'5" guard. Gavoni had him at number one on his recent rankings for the 2026 NBA draft. And then Cam Boozer also going to Duke next year. So Duke, if Flag returned, they'd be loaded with the Boozers going there, and with Flag, they'd probably be by far the favorites to win the national championship. But next year, there's more competition for that number one spot, and so you could go from number one to number four. Like that could happen.
And also, what happens if you end up with the same team you were trying to duck?
Yeah.
What'd you do that for?
Well, Charlotte's going to be there again, and Washington's going to be there again.
You're still a wizard.
I think Utah's still going to be there. I think a lot of those teams, like New Orleans might not be if Zion has a fully healthy year, but can you bet on that? San Antonio might not be there again because they might be in the playoffs and they won't have necessarily – well, I guess they'll have the Hawks pick, but maybe the Hawks will be better next year as well. So, you know. Might be the same crop of teams in a year. Toronto, who knows?
Could be bad news.
Could be bad news. I don't think Cooper Flagg's going to do it, but I do wonder if he's actually thinking about it. I do wonder. Steve, appreciate you joining me today, man. This was fun. Where can we find all of your stuff?
You can follow me, SteveJones20. Go anywhere where podcasts are provided and go look at the Dunker Spot and go listen to it. I'm really good at self-promos.
You're great, Steve. You're amazing. What one of the smartest people covering the game. It was great to do this pod with you today, man. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Thanks again to Steve Jones for joining me on today's episode. Give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you have not done that already, and follow us on Apple and Spotify. Give us a 5-star rating if you have not done so. It really does help out the show. Those 5-star ratings all add up. We're really moving up on Spotify. Let's move up on Apple. More 5-star ratings really does help us out. Thank you so much to Stone and to Mike for producing today's episode. We'll be back again later in the week with Tom Haverstraw. A lot going on in the NBA. College basketball tournaments this week. March Madness starting up late next week. I'm excited. Good time to be a basketball fan. Let's go, baby.